Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project. In this interview episode, I'm joined by the writer-director of Into the Forest, Patricia Rosema. Patricia shares with me how she went from not watching a movie until she was 16 to becoming one of Canada's most prominent filmmakers. Patricia talks about the success at Cannes for her debut film, I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, tackling an adaptation of Mansfield Park, working with Miramax and the Weinsteins, directing for HBO and streaming, and adapting Into the Forest and collaborating with Ellen Page and Evan Rachel Wood on the project, and we look at her new film, Mouthpiece. Thanks to Patricia for joining me for such an in-depth interview. We had such a great time talking that we went well over our time, and we do rush a little towards the end, but I hope you'll enjoy the chat and all the insight from Patricia. It was a real treat to be involved in this one. Me and Dallas will be back together next week to review The Black Coat's Daughter and Free Fire, and we'll have a bonus interview with director Ben Wheatley too. So join us next week, and thanks to everyone for listening to this interview. When I was sort of doing a bit of research into sort of your film history, how you became a film talent, I'd read that you didn't get a chance to visit the cinema until you were 16. That must be a unique experience for a filmmaker. What kind of stopped you seeing film until sort of you were 16? And what was your relationship like with film at that young age?
I don't remember any interdiction. I don't remember, you know, don't see movies, they're bad for your soul. There was nothing, it just wasn't part of my life in the same way that opera isn't part of lots of people's lives, or a theater isn't, or, you know, a certain brand of fiction. It just wasn't there. I grew up in a fairly small town, but it was also a Dutch Calvinist family that hadn't grown up on movies. In fact, I asked my grandmother once, after I'd made I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, I said, you know, Dad, were there any artists in our family? This is all in Dutch, you know, but I said, were there any artists or people who wrote stories or made music or anything? And she thought about it, and she said, no, they were all normal. You know, the first movie she ever saw in a theater was my movie, I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, and she was in her 80s or something. So it just wasn't part of the landscape. I had lots of, you know, quality fiction that I read. I had lots of beautiful music. My mother loved opera. I listened to all kinds of things. You know, I didn't have a broad experience of popular culture of the day, except that I had a little red transistor radio and I could listen to Motown, because Sarnia is close to Detroit. And so I got a lot of Motown in my early years. Just wasn't part of it. We were in the world, but not of the world, was the phrase, was the language of my time, of my, you know, little Dutch Calvinist. Christian Reformed is the name of the denomination. And we just didn't see it. Not until I was in my late, like 19 actually, did I see a double bill of Bergman movies with my then philosophy professor boyfriend, and that blew my mind, and that was the first time I thought, ah, there can be serious intent, there can be beauty, there can be poetry, then I suddenly just fell in love with the whole enterprise.
When you sort of fall in love with film like that, do you sort of then start diving into all the classics? Do you just sort of rent every single night from Blockbuster? How do you sort of evolve to have a relationship with film? Or is it one of those things that still is a rare treat or an opportunity to see a film at that kind of age?
It was still rare. I didn't see a lot. Then when I finished my degree in philosophy from this Dutch Calvin College and Seminary, where I went and did my degree, in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Paul Schrader went there. Paul Schrader and I have almost exactly the same formation, only he was 10 years older, except that he wrote Taxi Driver and stuff, but he went to Calvin College, and he had the same, didn't see any of anything until later stages. But, then when I moved, I had a short stint in Chicago and New York. I thought, oh, how am I going to, I love telling stories, I always wrote stories, but how am I going to make a living? I know I'll be a journalist, so I did journalism internships in Chicago and New York, and then came back to Toronto, worked as a journalist in junior capacity, and then just in all my free time went to the art house cinema and just consumed everything, read as much as possible, hungered for the technical. I love the Truffaut's book on Truffaut and Truffaut's book on Hitchcock, and I read American Cinematographer, and I just, anything where I could find, like, you know, storyboards or how they broke down schedules or why this lens and not that lens, just I took one 5-week night course at Ryerson, in, well, it was college at the time, now university, to just kind of learn the basics 101, and that's the extent of my film training. But I would say that my work doesn't come from other films, it comes from my life. Like, and that is a difference. And I always test things, not by, did it work well in another movie? Like when I'm kind of considering an idea, it's more, does that feel true? Does that feel like it really would, someone would speak that way or look that way? Or does this story feel like could actually happen? Is this believable to my life? Would my friends laugh at this joke? You know, would my family know that this was, you know, BS and posing? Or, you know, so it's, I adore films and I consume a lot, but it's not the well I dip into to make things.
What was the moment that you felt that you could turn this into a career, that you could go from journalism and studying film to being someone that could make it as a career, that we know how challenging it can be for females to even get a break into the industry? What was the moment that made you realize, I can go on and do this?
Well, I guess that moment would be in Cannes after the film had this extended ovation, and some hustly kind of guy, Harvey Weinstein, was saying, let me buy your movie, and then we sold the film to 40 countries. Then I really remember this moment is when I was applying for a new passport, and on the application it said profession, and I thought, wow, I can write filmmaker, and this is not bullshit. So the moment, I actually always thought it would be a hobby. I always imagined that I would have to have another career that would support my kind of problematic addiction to this form of storytelling. I always imagined it would be a, you know, artist in a garret kind of situation rather than, you know, an actual job. I couldn't imagine making money at it. I didn't know anybody who made money at it or could support themselves. Films were like clouds or mountains. They're beautiful and they're there, but you don't make them. When I made the first one, it was really very much almost a diaristic, even though it's not directly, you know, autobiographical or something. It's the emotions are and the imagery is, and it wasn't a career move at all. And then after that, with joy, I felt like I just might be good at it, being female and doing it. Almost, I knew that, you know, people want movies that are like themselves. They want movies that reflect their experience, their emotions, their griefs, their joys, their challenges. And I was so unlike anybody else. I felt like I was in the tiniest subgroup of a subgroup of a subcategory, that there was no way I was ever going to be successful or popular. So I, you know, I always felt like I was getting away with it. And I had, although my intent was serious, and I guess I have to thank, you know, a whole life of religion and then an education of philosophy, my intent was serious. I always felt like if I put enough sugar on the pill with humor and made sure the stories were very compelling, never let it flag, never let it bore, always be contributing, always adding, making such a new surprise, like sharp turns that you didn't expect. So I was, I always felt like I was kind of getting away with a career, not constructing one. And then I didn't even, the word career would make me a little bit sick. It was more like, you know, it was just like making love.
You sort of mentioned that you're a standing ovation at Cannes for I've Heard the Mermaids Singing. What was sort of the, from going from sort of, you know, you're a first-time filmmaker, how did the sort of film come around, and what was sort of the creation time on a film like that?
It was pretty quick, actually. I made a short film called Passion, A Letter in 16mm, and it was a story about a sort of successful career woman who was struggling with her passion for a lover and with her passion for excellence in her work, and the conflict of those two things. And I, because of my closetedness at the time, I invented, or I guess I thought I invented, a form. Because I kept thinking, well, poets can write a song to you, a poem to a person without identifying themselves, or a singer can sing a song in first person to someone else. But a filmmaker is always seems to be stuck with having the fly on the wall and showing both sides of the love affair. So I thought, well, maybe I don't have to do that. I'll do a entirely first person. So the movie is direct address and looking into the eyes of the audience and saying, you know, various things, but to, you know, speaking to the lover. So, and by the end of it, and I thought, okay, I'm going to be so radical. It doesn't have to be a story. Narrative is an oppression. You know, I'll just do it essay form. And the end, by the end of it, after I edited it together, it just felt like one damn thing after another. And it didn't have its own need to be watched. You know, it didn't have its own inevitability, so I actually hammered it into a narrative, and then from that point on became very convinced of the need for a very effective, you know, underlying story just to propel you along. But after that, I thought, okay, successful career woman, I'm going to do an unsuccessful career woman. So that was the first idea for I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, is unsuccessful career woman, and that struck me as a very funny thought. And I thought, I'm going to have someone, what could she be? My first thought was that she would be like a neg cutter, you know, like, which is a dead career. But, you know, she would cut the negative of nutritional films. And but she had all of these visions of grandeur and of artistic glory, but she doubted her ability to make it. But obviously, very self reflective. I mean, this is my story. I wasn't sure I had what it was to make something beautiful, and yet wanted it more than anything in the world, and was convincing myself over the course of the film that the wanting it is enough. Just do it. And if you're sincere, if your work comes from an honest place, it deserves to exist. So that was the sort of intent behind I've Heard the Mermaid Singing. I didn't have a title for a long time. It was just the title of the character. I loved the character. The thing was born from the character, Polly. And then her last name was Polly Vandersma, which is in Dutch. Vander is a you know, like a prefix and a sma is a suffix, like lots of, you know, names have, you know, kind of sma and whatever sma. So I had, but so she had a beginning and an end, but no middle. She had no substance to her. Like she was just a light, and like she was just like a bird just born. She was just a. Anyway, that's, I had this idea for this character. I had an idea for the point, and then I had an idea for the world. And I, instead of making her a neck cutter, I thought, no, I'm going to put her in a visual arts world because the films about films are so difficult to not have. Like they're so, the gag reflex comes up pretty quickly. So I thought, I'll make it about a girl who gets a job, like a temporary secretary who gets a job in a art gallery, and falls in love. And then I had this whole other structure of kind of trying to take down the idea of absolutes in art, and you know, so that. The gallerist was her name was Gabrielle Samper, so she was like God, and then, you know, her lover, and I was also trying to work in ways to have sort of lesbian content, and because that was my interest, and then I wrote it out quite quickly. I remember I wrote it on foolscap paper by hand, and I wrote it. I had done a half hour, and I thought, okay, the next thing I'll do is an hour. But then there was no money for an hour. I couldn't get, so I just went back and added some scenes to make it, and it went up to 71 pages. And I went to the arts councils and to some new funds in Canada for feature films, and they said, it's not long enough to be a feature. And I said, and I did my research, and it's like Woody Allen did Zelig. That was, you know, I think, what, 81 minutes. So I actually got them to consider it a feature and got, you know, $250,000 to make it, and gathered people around. Actually, I called up Adam Agoyan because I had seen his first film, Next of Kin, and I said, Adam, I saw your movie. It was one, like it lasted 1 week in the cinema, but I saw your movie and it was amazing, and I want to make a movie. Can you tell me how to make a movie? And he laughs. We laugh about it. We're good friends now. But so he sort of, you know, kind of told me where he got the funding and introduced me to a couple people that I ended up using to shoot it. And then I made that movie, and I edited it overnight the National Film Board. There was a guy who was cutting his documentary during the daytime, and then I would move in when he left at 6 o'clock, and I would stay until 6 a.m. editing, and then I'd sleep during the day and come back. And then on the table, on a cart, like a table there, they had different applications for festivals, and there was one for a festival called Cannes, and I thought, no one needs to know I'm applying. Like, I didn't really know what it was, but and anyway, I filled out the application and sent it in, and a gentleman named Pierre-Henri Delot thought, I sent in my 3 reels of 16mm film, and they watched it, and they, so it was brought into the director's fortnight. And so there I was, suddenly having to blow it up to 35 and find my way into Cannes, and it was a beautiful, beautiful way to come into the industry, because I didn't come in with visions of glory or wealth, or I just wanted to make this thing, and it was received so well. It broke my heart. I just cried when I thought, with this huge audience, because I had always thought I was more alone than I was. I thought that what I liked could never be shared to that degree. So it was a very, very, very moving and pure moment for me that no one can ever take away.
That's amazing, because, you know, it makes it feel like it was all that worthwhile. And What's Canada like as a sort of a filmmaking country? Does it encourage young, diverse talent like yourself, or is it quite a traditional one? Has it changed much over the years?
Well, I was very lucky. You know, Malcolm Gladwell's theory of outliers. I really was an outlier because when I was coming into my own, or just coming into the age where you want to make something, I was just old enough to make a movie. That's when there was new money, arts councils, and Telefilm Canada, that they had just kind of decided that they were going to be sort of way into the world of fiction film. We'd been so strong on documentary for so long, and but features were still very few and far between, and I didn't realize how few and far between. I just wanted to make one. But it's a very progressive culture, and we were then so small on the world stage. We didn't think of film as a business. We thought of it as an art form. So it wasn't. So I come up with this strange little movie script, you know, but it made people feel something. So I remember getting a call from someone from Telefilm Canada saying, "I'm calling you as an individual, not as a person who works at Telefilm, but I am going to do whatever I can to get this movie made because it made me cry." And I go, you know, whatever. Whatever. It was very. It was so early, and I think they just had some money, and I wasn't asking for much, and they threw it my way, and it had what it needed to travel. But Canada, yeah, we're not, you know, we were always considered a kind of a boring culture, which is kind of annoying, given that we come up with the likes of Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell and Margaret Atwood and, you know, Alice Munro, and but that somehow has been a bit of the cliche around the country. But I actually think that the mainstream has been so completely dominated by America, you know, and we have such an inferiority complex because we can't maintain a star system. Like, and as soon as we get an actor who's amazing, then they always go to the American system, and the whole agent system is designed to sort of set precedences for fees, and then you can't, those people can't come and work in, you know, smaller Canadian, like wholly funded Canadian films anymore. So it's always been this struggle to maintain a personality and a presence. But the rewards are huge for someone like me who self-selected out of a Hollywood system a little bit because I didn't, there's no way they were ever going to let me have female leads, have lesbian storylines, and have big stars and have big budgets. It just wasn't going to happen. And I knew I was, forgive me for the arrogance of the sentence, but I knew I was ahead of my time, and I knew that the world would catch up, and it has. And the films exist, and I got to have a career making them, and I didn't have to have all kinds of people telling me, you know, okay, put a male lead in there, and then, you know, throw in Sean Connery, and then you'll be fine. You know? I knew that it, and I looked at people like I looked at Fassbender or something, and I thought, okay, he didn't he worked with what he had in front of him and made greatness, you know. So it's not actually. I remember after I made A Heard the Mermaid Singing, I met Stephen Frears, and he invited me to the set of A Dangerous Liaison, and I had read the novel, and I was very excited to go, and I was here. I was in Paris at an unbelievable, ornate room, and the lights and the equipment and everything. And, you know, Glenn Close and John Malkovich was you know, very, very elevated and compared to what I could muster. And but then I thought, still just the camera, still just actors talking, and you know, in a room, I can get all that together. Still just a dolly track. I can get that together. So I somehow had a feeling, and I tried always to convince myself that I didn't need a huge budget in order to have some kind of impact. And I don't need to be popular to carry on. I feel like I'm sneaking by with this career as it is. I just need to be able to have it do well enough that I can do the next one.
I sort of first became aware of you when you took on Mansfield Park in 1999. What was it like for you to join the list of directors who have adapted Jane Austen films to the screen, and how did something like Mansfield Park come to yourself?
Well, Harvey Weinstein, who bought I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, you know, and that's its own whole story. Happy to talk about if you want, but he sent me the novel of Mansfield Park, and he was just trying to capitalize on the Jane Austen, you know, popularity at the time. And I sort of said no off the top, actually. I said, I don't want to do another tea party. You know, I just felt too twee or something for me. And then he said, well, just read the novel at least. Come on. So I read it. And I felt this sense of outrage for the Fanny Price character, who was just treated like a load of baggage. Like, she was just like a piece of luggage that was just moved around. It had no rights or dignity in the situation at all. And then I started reading, I read the novel, and then I called back and said, wait a minute, I actually might be interested in this. I feel, because I'm really feeling something in this, and I felt like that character almost represented me as a Canadian vis-a-vis England, and you know, and the colonies have always felt a little bit of an inferiority complex, and I felt like that's what it would feel like for me to make the movie in the UK. I would just feel like I was surrounded by a much more mature and evolved culture, but don't I deserve to exist too? Anyway, I could find myself in it, and I could find something passionate in it, and then I read around it, and I read this incredible essay by a woman from Bristol University, and she said that Mansfield Park was about slavery, and that it was about treating humans as possessions, and pointed up the fact that isn't that sort of a dominant in the novel, but pointed up the fact that all of the money made was made through slavery. And then I read about, you know, the Mansfield Judgment. She doesn't, and Austen doesn't sort of title her novel lightly. Like, she, you know, sense versus sensibility, pride versus prejudice. She gets to the theme of things in her titles quite often. And I thought, Mansfield Park, that, like, that wasn't arbitrary. That was Lord Mansfield, who had passed the first sort of limitation on slavery in England. Anyway, so I believed that Austen had more than a domestic comedy on her mind when she made this. I believed that, and she professed her love for certain abolitionist writers, so I actually really felt like she had a kind of a bigger intent. And again, she would have Sugar on the Pill, which is a domestic comedy. Then I was suddenly excited. Then I thought, oh my God, this is going to the heart of one of the biggest questions of colonialism. It's like, how much do we owe the people that we ruined in order to become wealthy? you know, how much, like, who's paying for this party is one of the lines in the film. So, you know, these were, I made more explicit what I felt like Jane Austen herself was grappling with when she wrote that novel, and that her audience would have been fully aware of. They would have known what the weight of that title, and they would have known what it was to be a slave owner and have a, you know, the son railing against the father in that context. So I just felt like I had something really of great weight to discuss, and I could add something to the canon, and I could still have all of the pleasures of the humor of it and the romance of it and, you know, the visual joy of it. So suddenly it was very exciting to me. And then I, you know, I broke down the novel and I broke it into, and I actually did a funny thing, which is I wrote it first as a contemporary piece. Because I thought, there has to be a real reason do something historical. It's, you can't just do historical for its own sake. Like, it's being seen by contemporary people, so it has to work emotionally, politically, for a contemporary audience. So I wrote it as a story of, you know, a family, a wealthy family, absent parents, all living luxuriously on ill gotten wealth, you know, and then the kid is thrown in, you know, not respected, considered a second-class citizen, and that was the Fanny Price character. Anyway, it was rich, beautiful material. I wrote it in a flurry, and Harvey loved it, and I met up with David Auchin and Alan Reich and Sarah Curtis in the UK, and we all got along, and it was shot actually fairly soon after. The first person I met for casting it was Harold Pinter. We had dinner, and that was David Auchin's idea, and Harold was in one of his own plays, acting in one of his own plays, so I got to see him, and I thought, oh my God, all of these pretentious Pinter-esque pauses are, in fact, in his mouth, very naturalistic. They're just the weird awkwardnesses, she says, being awkward, but they're just the weird stumbles and awkwardnesses of normal human speech. And so I actually felt convinced that he could act to a kind of a naturalistic level that I would feel comfortable with. So he was the first one recast, and then anyway, it was just a shocking embarrassment of riches. Lindsay Duncan is just heaven, you know. And then Johnny Lee Miller has never spoken a false word in his life on screen. Anyway, I don't know. Anyway, it was a joyful thing for me because I just suddenly felt like I had it. I could play on a larger scale with a bigger canvas and feel like I was doing something that mattered. And I was very moved recently when Cameron Bailey, who runs the Toronto International Film Festival, who's black, and who said that he thanked me for that film. He said, I know, you know, that it wasn't appreciated in its day. It was 1999. And I had lots of the reviews where, oh, she's imposing this, you know, racial concerns on something that Austen certainly didn't have that in her mind. And anyway, I felt proud of that piece.
What was it like, sort of, in the 90s, working within sort of that Weinstein company and Miramax, that a lot's been written about, sort of what they did for sort of independent cinema at the time and pushing sort of that forward? What was it like to actually work within it? We know what we've all got our thoughts from the outside looking in on their work in the 90s, but what was it like for you to be involved in that?
The Weinsteins did a lot for independent cinema, and I never felt any interference with my work. I have heard since that Harvey was unusually respectful of me, and I think partly because I was one of his first films that he got. Like I've heard The Mermaid Singing was one of the first ones. I think he'd done a few more, and so I wasn't like he trusted me more. Anyway, and I just didn't. I don't have trouble with obnoxious, powerful men because I just don't think they deserve any more respect than the next person. So they don't scare me at all, and I think that was appealing to him. He was, he spoke in a vulgar way, but there was never anything like he never, attacked me or did anything horrible, and I was just I completely reject him now and everything because of what's come to light. And I think only a life of anonymous service and devotion and humility in front of, the poorest people in the world could ever possibly redeem that behavior. But as far as my experience, it was I was offered a movie, was given the means to make the movie. After I was finished the movie, I was told, this is one of the best movies my company has made. He was like a bullshitter and a thug, but he was a very artistically, he was a thug with good taste, So after the film was done, he said, is there anything else you want? You want to, any shots or anything that you didn't? I said, well, I'd love to open it with a helicopter shot, of course. And of course, so then I got a helicopter shot out of it. And there was a kind of a little problem with the whole slavery storyline. I had thought of it as a theme, but in fact, it had become its own storyline and it needed to be resolved. So I had to go back a couple of months later. But nobody told me to. We got twice into the research screenings that people felt like the slavery issue was unresolved. And I thought, well, how the hell do you resolve the slavery issue? Just have someone come out and say, ooh, slavery's bad. Like, I didn't know what that meant. And Harvey unlocked it for me. He said, well, you have to resolve it between the father and the son. And that's all he said. And then that, I thought, you are entirely right. And I wrote a scene between the father and the son. And we went back at great expense to, and I love this scene with Harold and James Purfoy. And that solved the problem. It resolved the issue. Hit Harvey's or Miramax at the time, their belief in the perfectibility of films allowed me to bring this film to another level. I mean, I think it was wildly out of control, and I can't comment on all the other horrors and other deeply distressing things that happened, but I wasn't party to them.
I'm curious as well that into the sort of the 2000s, television sort of became more prominent and a place for great filmmakers like yourself to produce great work. You worked in television shows like Amazon's Mozart in the Jungle, a show I'm really fond of. HBO's In Treatment and Tell Me You Love Me. What was it like sort of in the 2000s when television was getting that more credible and it was a place that great directors like yourself could go and bring the big screen sort of vision that they had to the small screen on what would eventually become streaming platforms and things like HBO?
Well, I have always just been attracted to story, You know, and the scale of the production, or the famousness of the people in it, or the size of the screen, or the that isn't. It all ends up on a smaller screen anyway, eventually. So that I was aware of. So I would just respond sometimes to people's invitation to do something, and turn down a lot of big films with that would offer me a lot of money and possibly a huge audience, because they didn't. It just didn't interest me. It's not something I would go to see. It's not something I would want my name on. I'm too proud. So, but when Tell Me You Love Me came along, the title, someone called me up and says, hey, I want you to direct my pilot. I said, oh, what's it called? It's called Fuck Me, Please. And I thought, oh, that's catchy. What's it about? And I thought, oh, it's just kind of sex, and I love sex. I love the presentation of it. I think it's just profound for all of us, and it takes up much of our mind and much of our motivation. And but you know how to present it. But it can't just be. It's its own engine. Once you sort of set people on that course, that's all they can think of. So I don't like something that's just purely about sex. But if it's sexuality and something else, then that. That's mesmerizing. So, I thought it was just porn, and then when I read it, it felt like a very intimate human document, and it felt very true and real, and the writing was breathtakingly honest to me, and it was about, you know, couples. It wasn't couples struggling with infidelity, it was couples struggling with just various sexual issues, and I just was moved. I had no strategy. I was moved. I wait until something matters, until something feels like it needs to be made. So I jumped into that, and I treated it like any other project of mine. You know, when you're not the originator of something, however, and somebody else is ultimately holds to the kingdom, like when somebody else ultimately is the one who can decide what's in and what's out, that it takes it's less pressure and it's less reward. You know, it's a position of more humility and ego management. I still try to bring as much of myself and make. So for all of these things, Mozart in the Jungle, I loved doing that. And in treatment was more difficult, actually. That wasn't a very satisfying, except I loved Gabriel Byrne, was amazing. When you're just a bus driver, and that's what you can be on a lot of these television series, if you're not involved in the creation of it, and if your episode is just pretty much prescribed, then the cinematographer, they know what they're doing already. The actors know what they're doing already. The writers have set the whole thing. Then you're really, like the AD could direct it in a lot of these series, right? A lot of series don't actually really need much of a director at all. Then I would rather be in the sandbox at home making my own little thing. I don't need to just say I directed or did you jump on a train that's already going, and I don't need it. So anyway, small screen stuff, I only do what really, really appeals to me, and I don't care what the length is or what the size of it is. I loved everything I went into. I just went into because it would be something that I would watch, and then I felt like I had something to contribute to. But I don't do it a lot right now, and I could because now women are in style. I don't do it that much because I know myself. I need to feel like I'm actually making something. I mean, there's some invention, there's some discovery and newness in it. I have to be trying a new tone or or a kind of a new camera approach. That'd be something new for me, new and beautiful, and that deserves to be made. I often say when we're shooting and people are getting tired or they're losing focus, or I always say, people, our bones will be dust, and this will still be here. You know, so I have this kind of almost, probably comes from my religious background, but I have this religious devotion to making something as pure and as perfect as possible. But if I can't do that, and someone, I often think if I'm painting and I have a brush, and I've got someone else hanging on to the back of the brush, you know, yanking it this way and that, but like I can't do what it is that I do. So, but I look at things like Big Little Lies and, you know, first season of Handmaid's Tale and, this show Euphoria I'm quite taken with right now. There's some extraordinary work being made out there. So what was it like in the 90s? I veered off there for a while. As I said, I can go on. But HBO was a really special place to work because they weren't a business. They were people with great taste experimenting. And even if things didn't do well in the first season, they'd stick with them sometimes if they really believed in them. And I think that is partly a function of the subscription model, which has a lot more patience built into it. So I'm very happy about that. And I'm very happy about this development where things can be whatever length they are designed to be. I can't stand the idea of having to work to extremely tight time schedules and then being interrupted by commercials. That seems like the worst offensive way to present your work. And I can't imagine a Margaret Atwood being told, well, you can either write a 200-page novel or a 300-page novel. And we're going to tear out some of the pages and put some commercials, put some ads in the middle of it. Like, it's just not a healthy system. So I believe that, you know, the streamers and have allowed us to actually let fictional film, you know, storytelling be truer and more individualistic and more varied and ultimately pleasing and real.
I want to get your take on one thing that you touched on, Big Little Lies there, and sort of a fellow A24 filmmaker herself, Andrea Arnold. It's sort of broken in the news this week about sort of she's gone on and shot, you know, the second season of this show. You know, I love her work, like Red Road, American Honey, for example. You know, she has such a great, unique style, and it's all come out this week that HBO and the editing team from that are taking what she's doing and twisting it into something completely different. Is that ever sort of a worry for you when you do these sorts of things? You describe it, you know, it could almost be like the bus driver, and once you've done your job, what people can maybe do with sort of your, you know, your heart and soul, how you've shot things, how you've put things together. Has that ever been a worry for you? And do you feel that that's something that might put off directors like, you know, maybe yourself and Andrea Arnold potentially doing television again in the future?
I walk into it with this knowledge that they're just going to cut it the way they want. You know, there's a 3 or 4 days allowed for the, quote, director's cut, and then I don't think they actually really care particularly what you do, and then they make whatever they want from it. I walk in with my eyes open, which is why I say less stress, you know, less reward. I think that situation is different because, you know, Jean-Marc Vallée has done something very important for television series, at least, which is to really build up the concept of an auteur, you know, TV director, or at least a, you know, premium cable director. But so that's an exciting development. I think he's done a lot for that. Like, he goes in and he often rewrites, doesn't take credit, but or you know, or is involved very deeply in a restructuring of things. So I love his work. I've loved it from the beginning. And so I don't know what Andrea Arnold's work look like. I look at the show now and I love it. I can't wait to see next week. But I guess I just want to look at the contract. Did you have final cut or not? If you don't have final cut, you don't have final cut. I had final cut. I've had final cut on most things, but I get it on a percentage of the audience approval. So if I do a test screening and it's over a certain, you know, score, then I've got final cut. If it's under a certain score, then they can take it away. That's kind of disgusting, but it's the other people, non-filmmakers, are deciding what the film should be. That's heartbreaking, but I'm also very aware that it's a business. So when I make something like Mouthpieces, film you just saw, that's thrilling to me, because no one's gonna, there's never any tiny question whether I have final cut, and I keep the budget low, and I, you know, but it doesn't go as far either. It doesn't go as far because it doesn't have movie stars in it, and it's so unique and strange. So the smaller the budget, the more freedom and the more control you have, and the bigger the budget, the more people you have to listen to. And I've just always assumed that equation. So what am I saying? I'm saying I'd like to see Andrea Arnold's cut. I'd like to see that. So truly an artist. I don't know, you know, whether her contract was violated. I don't know. I think what she told, you can do what you as an artist want to do, and then that was denied. Well, then that's a crime.
So obviously we just spoke a few episodes ago about your movie Into the Forest, your 2015 feature starring Ellen Page and Evan Rachel Wood. And it was a real surprise for me when I went into this film. This was a first time watch for me, and I never realised it was adapted from a book. What was your introduction to the book, and when did sort of it come to you to adapt this into a feature?
Well, Ellen Page, I had been working on this very unusual story called The Paper Bag Princess, and I wanted to make it into a feature, but it's very expensive because it was a lot of animation and a lot of CGI and whatever. It was a big thing, and it turned out she had been circling that property at the same time, and then someone said, hey, do you want to, our people said, do you want to meet? So we met. And we got along like a house on fire. We knew some people in common, and both gay, and just, you know, similar taste. We had similar taste in music, and, you know, similar sense of humor, and whatever. We just got along very well. And then we kind of worked on that project. I did a few drafts. It was important for me to do a children's movie that had a gay positive note in it. Small, tiny, little, off to the side, not important, but had to be in there for me to feel like this was, I was furthering the conversation that needed to be had, and it felt like a frontier to do that in a children's film, or in a family, like, I didn't want to call it children's film, but a family film, like an all-ages film, but we could never get it off the ground, and then there were some rights and options stuff anyway, so that fell away, like, you know, a certain percentage of everything we do in this business. But then we developed this trust and this friendship, and she had optioned that novel, Into the Forest, and she was trying to produce it in the U.S., and did I want to direct it? And I read it, and I was completely taken by it, and said, absolutely. And one of our first conversations was whether or not the rape would be on screen or not. And I had ideas on how to do that without adding to the heap of images that, you know, humiliate women. And I went from there, and I wrote a screenplay, and she loved the screenplay right away. We didn't have last minute the funding fell through in the U.S. So then I brought it to a friend here in Canada, and we could actually have more money to make it here. So we made it in British Columbia, and then we got Evan Rachel Wood and Max Minghella to join the party, and off we went. That was actually another one that went fairly quickly. So she was producer on it, but when she was acting, she was fully an actor. But then she would have, you know, comments on the cuts, on the edits and stuff, and it was very respectful in that I couldn't imagine making a movie that she didn't love, and she couldn't imagine making a movie that I didn't love. So it was really, we did disagree on some things, if we disagreed, we just kept talking until we found some alternate answer that would work for both of us, you know, or we convinced one or the other. It was just assumed that we would agree and that nobody had power over anybody else, that it was just, we were going to keep working until we both agree. But it was a joy that way. She's so, and Evan Rachel Wood too, they're so want to be pushed to the edge. They want the extreme. They're both child actors. I wonder if this somehow, you know, some such young women that they could have so much power right at their fingertips. It was really thrilling to shoot. And the subject, for me, it was a whole new tone that I hadn't really approached before. And I love trying new tones. I love to just, I actually once heard Paul Schrader speaking actually last year about his approach to screenwriting and filmmaking, and he's saying he's only ever attracted to doing something he's never done before. Because he looks at these filmmakers who do the kind of basically the same thing over and over again, like, aren't you just going to fall asleep? This is like, the joy is in going, I wonder, I've never seen this before. I wonder if you could take this kind of story, in my case, this one, a post-apocalyptic, you know, story, and then add this, and, you know, what would that tone feel like, and could it work? So the hunger for novelty in your own work, just to keep yourself awake and excited about it, is something I share with Schrader, and I'm thinking, is this a lapsed Calvinist tendency, or am I just, you know, maybe many have it, and I make more of it because we have similar backgrounds, I don't know. So yeah, it was good. It was very, and we're friends, and we're always looking for other things to do too. That was a very, very positive experience for me. You know, I knew that the ending, it was a kind of an ending about blowing up civilization if it doesn't work. I knew that that wasn't going to be something that would be commercially very accepted. You know, it was beautiful that A24 bought it, but I always knew that it was never going to be a giant hit because of certain choices, and I'm happy to make choices that don't please a lot of people. I just have to please enough people.
One of the things that I was curious about that when we were sort of discussing the movie a few weeks ago was we discovered sort of one of the big changes from the book was that in the book it's a nuclear blast that causes this power outage, whereas in the film we preferred how you'd gone with the approach. It was quite low key, it was ambiguous for the reasons behind it. Do you feel pressure when you're adapting things? Like obviously you mentioned with Mansfield Park, you know, originally sort of doing this kind of modern day take on it. Do you feel pressure to sort of the source material and perhaps its listeners, or do you have to make it something that you would enjoy reading, enjoy seeing kind of brought to life?
Well, just to clarify, the modern day take for Mansfield Park was not ever intended to be a modern day film. Mm-hmm. It was just a way of writing so that it felt urgent and, you know, human and relatable for me. And then I translated it into the times And then I took as many lines from Austin, and I took us, you know, and I all the conventions and whatever. So it was just a way of staying in touch with the human heart, which I don't think changes that much over time. Sorry, what was your question again?
Sorry, did you feel pressure to stick to the source material when adapting Into the Forest, or, you know?
Well, Into the Forest, it was more than it wasn't a nuclear blast. It was a whole progression of events. Have you read this book?
No, I haven't had the chance.
It was more complex than that. It was actually, it was a very, very iterative kind of loss of civilization. The government collapsed, and then there was environmental collapse, and then there was, like, it was a whole series of things. So the schools kind of sort of fell and, you know, stopped functioning. So so that wasn't a giant change. But there were definitely some changes from the novel. I think a truly, like, a so-called faithful adaptation of a novel would be to film the pages. Because a novelist is so much more than just the story. A novelist, you know, sweats over the length of the sentences and the paragraphs and, you know, the punctuation and what's internal and what is done in dialogue and what is done in description and points of view. It's like a novel is so much more than just its events. So I feel like as a filmmaker, you have to find a cinematic correlative, not... I think a lot of the really boring adaptations and films that actually don't do justice to their novels are in fact very, very faithful because they don't actually catch the spirit of the novel and they don't transform you have to find a way, like in a movie, sorry, I'm being very inarticulate here, but in a movie you get what they do and what you see, you know, what you see and what they say. That's all you get. But in a novel, you get how they think, descriptions, long descriptions. I can't do long descriptions. I can't weigh the point of view of the audience with my descriptions. I only get pictures and sounds. So it's a whole different toolkit, and so you have to find a complementary cinematic method of achieving the author's goals. But ultimately, and this is a radical thing to say, the novel is a resource, and it's my first job is to make a beautiful, relevant, urgent, present, raw film, and then my second task is to reflect the intentions of the original author. And I consider an adaptation to be like an engagement with the original material, not a slavish reproduction.
One of the things that I love about your movies, and it was actually how I first discovered heard about Into the Forest a few years ago, is your use of music. And I love Cat Power. And I remembered a few years ago, I think it was the end of 2015, and David Ehrlich, the IndieWire director, releases this compilation of the year with songs and music from it. And I remembered hearing the Cat Power music playing over, I think it was like Jackie and the top films of that year. And I was like, wow, what film has this come from? And then I looked into it and it was Into the Forest, and I bookmarked checking out the film based on that song alone of like, well, that's a brilliant song. I wonder how it's used in the film. that was how I first kind of...
You just made my day. That's really, really beautiful. I love that.
How do you go around soundtracking your films, and how did you pick this song? Because it plays quite a key role in this film. It's not used once, but twice. How did you sort of settle on this thing, and what's your relationship with music and film?
Well, music, you see, I don't know who said this first, but music is the art form to which we all aspire, or to which all other art forms aspire. You know, it forms my life. It's very, very important to me. And I'm writing right now, and I'm listening to a certain piece of music on a loop because it keeps me at a pitch and it keeps the emotion in the right place for the entire film. I use it to help define tone. I'm constantly on the hunt for new music, and both my children are very involved in music, and we share back and forth, and I'm really excited by a lot of contemporary. Anyway, that particular song came in an interesting way, which was that I hired an extraordinary, one of the top five choreographers in the world. I think the Guardian has backed me up on that. Crystal Pite is her name, P-I-T-E, and she is an amazing choreographer, and she was choreographing the dance for Evan Rachel Wood in the film, and then I was gonna hire another actor to play the dance teacher in there, and then when I watched Crystal teaching Evan how to dance, Crystal Pite, like, ended up casting in the movie, was using that piece of music, and actually, you know what? I'm wrong. It was Evan Rachel Wood was listening to it, and she was using it just to inspire herself to dance. And I didn't know. I had heard other, you know, covers of that piece. It just took me away. The language was perfect for the movie. The lyrics were perfect. Ellen adored it. Ellen got in touch with, we couldn't afford it, you know. So she got in touch with Cat Power and said, can you help us? And, you know, she could and she couldn't, and then we had to go through all this. It cost us a lot relative to our budget, but after we'd heard and seen the dance to that piece, we couldn't think of anything else. So I'm very happy to. I always have a plan. I always kind of have everything all laid out, what the movie is going to be, and then I discover things and find them and change. I don't have any ego attached to having, you know, pre-visualize every tiny moment or every piece of music or every sound. I always need a plan because I feel like I can, you know, I just need that. It's for like in a shot list and shot design, and everything's very carefully worked out. And then, oh my God, the light in this direction is way better than it is in that direction right now. So throw that out and do something else. So anyway, that wasn't planned, and we found in the process and pre-production, and that's when we went with Max Richter. Ellen and I got on the phone with him and said, Max, you have to do this movie. And he said, oh, thank you, that's very nice. And it was like a conference call, the three of us. And he said, yeah, no, that's great. I'm very, very busy, and I don't think you can afford me right now. And he said, yeah, no, that's interesting, Max, but you have to do this movie. And then he said, oh, that's really flattering, and blah, 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 and I love the script, and he actually took the time to read it. But Max, you have to do this movie anyway. So we just insisted long after it was polite, and finally we figured out a way for him to do the score for it. was it like?
What was it like when sort of the film had sort of premiered at Toronto and then A24 picked up the distribution rights? What's it like for you as a filmmaker when someone like A24 wants to add your film to their filmography? And what's their reputation like amongst sort of filmmakers and talent like yourself for what they do? And is there any films in their filmography that really stand out to you that you perhaps love?
A24 has very quickly made themselves into tastemakers. You know, they don't follow their lead. Their name, through their careful and tasteful choices, became huge instantly, almost instantly. You know, Under the Skin was something that was really a striking movie for me, and I loved very much. High Life I had seen. They've got First Reformed, which is Lady Bird. What else do they have? They're brilliant. So. And people will go to their work, go to their films because of their name, and they don't even know the movie or the project. What else? The Lovers, unbelievable. So I think their bread and butter has become elevated genre. And I haven't really worked in genre that much, though I have some ideas that I want to try. And that has that's a kind of very sophisticated business model, I think, that's worked very well for them. And then they've kind of tapped into a hunger for authenticity that I don't think other, distribution companies were doing at that time. So they're the gold standard right now for me.
When you look at your place within their filmography as a director and this film itself, that it seems that they have a strong record and they back films with female leads, female directors. What's that kind of like for you to know that there's people out there that are putting these movies front and center? Is that an exciting opportunity for you? And should more people, as you kind of mentioned there, they're setting the pace. Should more people be looking to do what they are, introducing these sort of filmmakers into their filmographies?
Well, they were ahead of the game, you know. So they got a head start, and they have a kind of respectability. People who are coming to the idea of diversity now are a bit late to the party. They're welcome in the party, but A24 was one of the first, so that speaks well of them, and it speaks well of their choices. Of course, the world is sick of seeing the world only through only seeing the kind of white male, arc of triumph. People have seen the whole world, kind of Western world, let's say, but the Western world has been, the dominant stories have only been white cis males telling their experience. So now let's hand over the microphone and the camera to the rest of that, to the rest of the people on the planet. it seems obvious, but it's slow, 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 slow. It's glacial, in fact. I'm thrilled to see. I'm so excited. I mean, you see films like Marginal Experience, like the experience of being in the margins, forces a kind of invention sometimes. So you see movies like Get Out, and you see movies like Sorry to Bother You, and you think, these could not have been made by white people. What's the other one? Moonlight. You know, like they are. There's a sort of a thrilling kind of invention that comes from having been an outsider. So if you want, you know, filmmaking to stay new and fresh and exciting and relevant, you have to get people who aren't the same old, making it.
And I think that brings us perfectly to Mouthpiece. So that's been sort of touring film festivals, and, you know, I've been lucky enough to catch it this week. And I think it makes it a fantastic companion piece to Into the Forest, you know, looking at two women after the, you know, and life after sort of the death of a parental figure.
That did cross my mind. I've always thought of it as a companion piece to I've Heard the Mermaid Singing. It feels more of a sister piece to that. But you're totally right. That's actually a really interesting comparison.
What was sort of Mouthpiece like for you? I've read that obviously you've had to create your own production company to bring this one to life. And I think this is one of my favourite films sort of of this kind of year that I've watched. What's been the journey for this film? And
wow.
And as it's starting to kind of make its way into the world, where will people be able to kind of find it in sort of the coming months?
this is a question I share with you, Lee. I don't know. We haven't cracked the European market yet. We did a limited release in the U.S. in New York and L.A. and it's done quite well in Canada. We had screening in London, and now you tell me Edinburgh. But I'm still trying to get it out there. I saw this play, and it had. It was quite different from the film, but it had something that grabbed me by the throat, which was two people playing one person. Two people look nothing alike, but they're playing internal debate that we all have, and especially, I think, women. This is sometimes in perfect sync and sometimes at beating each other up, these two voices in our head. That was an exciting thing to see physical life, because it's something we all feel. And I thought, when do you get a visual representation of something that you all know, but we've never seen it on film before? And, you know, I told various funders I want to make this into a movie, and they said, it's a very theatrical conceit, but, you know, that is not going to work on film. And I couldn't for the life of me understand why it wouldn't work. They said, because it's theatrical. And I said, how are you going to do it? And I'd say, you just do it. They said, but how are you going to represent two people on screen? I said, you just have two people walking beside each other. They're one person. Anyway, it was one of these kind of thrilling adventure. It felt like I was getting into Charlie Kaufman land, which I adore. I adore all the absurdists and theater, right? I grew up on Pirandello and Ionesco and, you know, Pinter and Beckett. And I feel like there's a kind of a branch of cinema that I've always been attracted to, which is, you know, Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman. And it felt like it was kind of in that category, but it was very, you know, female-led, and so it just felt like a brand new piece of filmmaking for me. I didn't have to make my own production company. I call it Crucial Things, but I always wanted to. I always wanted to have my own company because I want to do my own work and maybe other people's work. It's a way of actually being able to push things forward faster. But I made a choice to make this movie very quickly and not get a sales agent for it first. And now normally that process, you get your sales agent and they sell the film to various countries, and that's part of the financing, and then those countries have already bought it, and then they have to distribute it. So I didn't have a sales agent on board, and so now I don't have a sales agent on board, and people love it, like cry, and are very moved by it, and are very affected by it, or they're thrilled by the invention of it. And some people go, those people who aren't moved by it don't come up to me. But so I know it has a giant impact, but I just haven't been able, the business model doesn't work. I don't know, somehow getting a feature out into the theatrical market in Europe hasn't worked yet. It toured Mexico. It went to 15 cities in Mexico. So it's a very, it's an odd film with an odd career right now. So if you have anybody listening to this who wants to see a beautiful movie and help me get it out to the world, then I would be happy.
Yeah, it was our fifth. We on our other podcast, we take part in the 52 Films by a Woman Pledge, and each week we recommend a film directed by a woman to check out and where to check it out. And this week's one, as of recording, was Mouthpiece here on Friday. So yeah, it's a real treat to see a film like this coming along to Edinburgh and getting out here into Europe.
That's fantastic.
And kind of finally.
Oh, that's really good news.
And kind of finally, if people wanted to kind of keep up to date with your filmmaking, any news, if Mouthpiece is making it to their neck of the world, where would you recommend people would kind of best engage with?
Well, Mouthpiece Movie, is the Instagram account. I'm online as Patricia, at Patricia Rosemond. PatriciaRosema.com. I'm, not always good at the self-promotion side of it, because I always just want to keep moving forward, and I always have this feeling like I'm not for sale, the films are for sale, but maybe if I sold myself a little bit more, I might be a little long in the tooth for that, but I'm that's not always been my strong suit, is keeping the world abreast of my work. So anyway, those two things could be helpful. This podcast and your interest, Lee, and your help with that, banging the drum about Mouthpiece, that means a lot to me. I really appreciate it.
No, it's been a real pleasure, and thank you for going back and looking over your filmography and talking with us. It's been a real treat to talk with you tonight, and as I say, I'm hopefully this will get people that maybe haven't seen your work before to check it out, and it's been a real treat. So thank you very much, and I wish you all the best with Mouthpiece and what's still to come.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and what I have, not irrational. I actually have this belief that my best work is yet to come. I feel like I've tied all of these different tones and these different kind of cinematic adventures, and now I just feel like, okay, now I know exactly why I'm put on this planet. So, anyway.